Good evening and welcome, everyone. It is so good to see each of you here this evening. You are a blessing to all of us. Thank you. So we join together and affirm together that there is light divine, there are laws of our universe, and there is grace and mercy, the good and the truth for each of us to our fulfillment of our destiny during this lifetime. So we begin in the name of God transcendent, God omnipresent, and God immanent, the Holy Living Trinity. Amen. So we begin by remembering that we are now in the sixth week of Easter. Today is the Feast of the Ascension, which Thomas Keating says it is the celebration of the cosmic Christ, which means that Christ is resident in every particle, every event, everything that exists. So our opening reflection this evening will again come from Jean de Salzman, and we continue to especially honor her life during this time. Her date of death was May 24th, 1990, at the age of 101. Her reflection comes from our community reading, The Reality of Being. She says, "What do I understand today? And what do I need to understand? Understanding depends on my state of being, on my state of presence. It is absurd to pretend in my sleep that I wish to work, while all the time dreaming that I can. Our efforts to work in life are, first of all, to discover how far we are from our highest possibilities. At the center of our work is the wish to live in a more real way. Simultaneous movements outward toward manifestation and inward towards a reality at the source. Two kinds of vibrations. We can be either an unconscious slave or a conscious servant." So tonight, this evening, we will speak directly toward this matter of being a conscious servant. And so it is. So we began to prepare ourselves and our being and our state of being by remembering, why are we here? What is my wish? What is my aim? And we do this quietly, asking that our heart to be open and to hear what it is ours to hear at this time. We let go of any fears to risk. This matters to our very selves, for one another, and for the world. And thus we place ourselves here with intention and trust and purpose, receptive to the influences that are coming and will come from the circle of conscious humanity. And we prepare to receive them with all the consciousness that we can muster. With back upright, mind quiet and directed attention, heart open, body relaxed, noticing perhaps and then releasing all tension, constriction, resistance. And we breathe in deeply all every most hidden part of our being, all being, everything. Everything that passed through us this day, our world today. Everything that hurt, that confused, that created fear, that brought heaviness, that left us feeling powerless, less than, more than, everything. Everything that uplifted, that loved, that brought joy. All affirming, all denying, and we hold it as offering, as reconciled, as food for being. We lift it and ask that it all be transubstantiated for and in our being. As whole, as lovely, as radiant, as beloved of God. We do this on behalf of everyone and everything. And we breathe out this healing life into the world, all worlds. I hand over all complexities. I hand over all plans. I hand over all anxieties and small fears of my heart. I open to the divine human life. I am here. I am. I wish. I can work. I stand unencumbered before God and one another. And so it is. So we will now enter into our time of Lectio Divina. And our passage will be read three times. Because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. Suffering is being poured out at each moment over the whole earth, like an immeasurable ocean. What makes up this immensity? Is it blackness, emptiness, barren waste? No. It holds hidden within it in extreme intensity the ascensional force of the world. For if all those who suffer in the world were to unite their sufferings in one single grand act of consciousness, would this not be one of the most exalted forms in which the mysterious work of creation could be manifested? We happen to be living now at a time when things are happening in the world, when great changes have to come about. Those changes can only come through people who are able to bear, who are able to stand the stresses that will come and that are already beginning. In every case, there is a preparation to commit oneself, to give oneself, to the future of humankind. We can help one another. Because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. Suffering is being poured out at each moment, excuse me, over the whole earth like an immeasurable ocean. But what makes up this immensity? Is it blackness, emptiness? Barren waste? No. It holds hidden within it in extreme intensity the ascensional force of the world. For if all those who suffer in the world were to unite their sufferings in one single grand act of consciousness, would this not be one of the most exalted forms in which the mysterious work of creation could be manifested? We happen to be living now at a time when things are happening in the world, when great changes have to come about. Those changes could only come through people who are able to bear, who are able to stand the stresses that will come and that are already beginning. In every case, there is a preparation to commit oneself, to give oneself to the future of humankind. We can help one another. Because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. Suffering is being poured out at each moment over the whole earth, like an immeasurable ocean. But what makes up this immensity? Is it blackness, emptiness, barren waste? No, it holds hidden within it in extreme intensity the ascensional force of the world. For if all those who suffer in the world were to unite their sufferings in one single grand act of consciousness, would this not be one of the most exalted forms in which the mysterious work of creation could be manifested? We happen to be living now at a time when things are happening in the world, when great changes have to come about. Those changes could only come through people who are able to bear, who are able to stand the stresses that will come and that are already beginning. In every case, there is a preparation to commit oneself, to give oneself to the future of humankind. We can help one another. And so it is. So I invite you to share what it is that you received from this passage, how the image spoke to you. What came to meet you? Melba, good evening.
Good evening. Hi, everybody. And the last month, I've had five of my friends pass away. And I'm really grateful for the Church of Conscious Harmony, and especially the writings of Gurdjieff that I've been reading, because I feel like it was a blessing to have started the Journey School and do the Gurdjieff movements and really dive into the commentaries, because in a way it was preparation for the month of April, where, like I said, five of my friends passed away, and they all died peacefully. And when I saw the image, the first thing that came to mind was how the skeleton figure had all plus signs. And that's how I've come to understand passing, transitioning in the vertical. And in every one of the memorials, we all talked about what a blessing, what a plus their life was to us. I feel that the Conscious Church of Harmony is doing the work and helping one another, but has really like showered blessings on me because I've changed my perception, or at least it's validated my perception of a lot of things. And one is the value of my own life. And I am committed to join all of you in that aim to take in deeply the vertical and celebrate the plus.
Thank you, Melba. Thank you for that gift for us. Thank you. Carolyn. Yes.
Hi, Marianne.
Hello.
Hi, everybody. The image was just so powerful. I was just so captivated by the image. This, all the people, from those who were so bent down that felt like the ocean of suffering, and all those gathered around, and as they stacked up, the sense of peace, and all the, so it felt to me like a quilt, people just stitched together and bearing the suffering together. And then the image of death with the crosses on it, the ascensional part of it. Wow. And I have to say, I don't understand that in my heart, but the image speaks to me of possibility and invitation.
Absolutely. Yes. Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you. Jim, yes, welcome.
Thank you. The passage spoke to me of how our suffering, or the suffering of others, is never wasted. That in fact, it can be used and is used to raise, to transform us, and to raise our consciousness to a higher level. And this, to me, follows the same pattern, I guess, of evolution in other areas of life, where certain life forms find themselves in trouble, in difficulty, and the trouble and the difficulty, along with, you know, changes, mutations, result in the evolution of other forms of life into new forms of life. So what we're seeing here in this passage is kind of evolution on a consciousness level, whereas we have mostly learned about evolution on a physical level, the level of the way things work and operate. So,
yes. Thank you, Jim.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So, Rachel, yes. Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, Mary. Hey, Marianne. I heard suffering holds hidden within it in extreme intensity the ascensional force of the world. And for me, that was even more reason to honor when I choose, when I feel my grief that I've not allowed myself to feel, maybe something from a long time ago. Because a lot of the time, if that wants to come up and I'm willing to lean into it instead of turning away, it can feel like a selfish act at times, or all, yeah, that's judgment coming in. But really and truly, if I can honor my suffering, it's in a way a gift, like a giving to community. So that can can be free of that and then allow more space for what's to come.
It's beautiful. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you. Well, we step into this vast subject this evening of conscious, intentional suffering as an aspect of self-remembering, and a grand aspect it is. So I am filled with joy in my heart to introduce Steve Utz, who will accompany us into this vast journey into self-remembering. Good evening and welcome, Steve.
Well, thank you, Marianne, and it's great to see you all on Zoom. And what I'd like to do is save plenty of time at the end of my presentation for sharing, whether of the homework or what we're talking about this evening. So allow time for kind of a free-for-all for that. I've been thinking about this. I was born in 1952, and right smack dab in the middle of the baby boom. And I was thinking about what was going on at that time. Beelzebub Tales was just published. In Search of the Miraculous was just published. Maurice Nickel was probably beginning to die of pancreatic cancer. Uspensky had just died a few years before. Thomas Merton published Seven Story Mountain. And there was something happening right then. And the torch is being passed through the children and grandchildren of Gurdjieff and Uspensky. And one of the things they left us with was this vague and mysterious area called second conscious shock and intentional suffering or conscious suffering and intentional labors and conscious suffering. And it feels like an unfinished symphony in a way. There was an attempt at organizing and categorizing it, but it kept getting revised. And I think when I'm doing this presentation tonight, what I want to include is the tradition of true contemplative Christianity that offers a perspective on conscious suffering, because I think it's the centerpiece of the Christian faith is consciously suffering. So I'd like to begin. I'm going to share my screen here. And we're going to just re-examine conscious suffering. And here's the basic classification from Gurdjieff. The four classifications of suffering are unnecessary suffering, unavoidable suffering, voluntary suffering, and intentional suffering. But as I look at that classification, The first two, unnecessary and unavoidable suffering, are adjectives that describe the character of the suffering. Whereas the last two, voluntary and intentional suffering, are adjectives that describe more the motivations of the sufferer. And then when you look at voluntary versus intentional suffering, the edges get blurred a bit because Araj, Gurdjieff's translator, viewed voluntary suffering as intentional suffering. So it kind of excluded the idea of intentional suffering. Gurdjieff insisted that voluntary suffering had a reward at the end of it. So if you wanted to have some money, you would save your money. You would budget, create a budget and save your money. So at the end, you would have money. Or if you wanted to train for a race, you would go into training for a race and you would have the reward that you were capable of training for the race, or capable of winning the race. And it was like intentional suffering should be for some purpose, altruistic purpose beyond ourselves. But when you think about it, when you're aligned within yourself and you're following your part dog duty and you're doing what you should be doing in life, there's an innate reward sense that one gets from that. So the edges get blurred a bit. Now, Bennett, this is a complicated slide, but I wanted to make sure I'm aligning the Christian perspective with the work perspective. Unnecessary suffering, which is generally first world problems. They're not really the things that other forms of suffering do bring up. It's things like worry and indignation and anxiety and doubt and grasping and self-love and impatience and regret. And these line up very well with Thomas Keating's programs for happiness, of power, control, esteem and affection, security and survival. And if you go through the commentaries, it's, and I hate to be critical of this, but it's our elite white people in mansion houses discussing these kinds of first world problems or unnecessary suffering. And it's good to do that. And it's a good practice field to run on, but that doesn't contain ascensional force. That's not what Teilhard was talking about in the Hymn to the Universe. The other thing is that unnecessary suffering and unavoidable suffering are not mutually exclusive Venn diagrams. They overlap. That unavoidable suffering attracts to itself, to the unconscious person, will attract to itself a lot of unnecessary suffering that makes matters worse. And you can see this here in this diagram, that if you have something that comes into your life, an unavoidable event, and you're unconscious about it, all these things show up. And they weigh you down and can make you bitter and can make you crystallized and make you isolated. And sometimes it causes you to suppress that suffering because you can't cope with it. And this is what Father Keating talked about in the divine therapy, what he used to call the need for unloading, that going in deep into silence and touching the bottom of the pool and revealing these unresolved sufferings and this unloading that has to occur and the pain that goes with that. But it's clearing out, it's a purgative process to clear out that deep psychic trauma. And then something that's not been touched on much in our circles is the trauma from oppression, racial oppression, oppression of women, oppression of those based on their sexual identity. And these are real issues that are coming to fore right now. But a truly prophetic voice that is underappreciated in the literature is Howard Thurman. And I just want to take a moment for a shout out to Howard Thurman. I just ordered another 6 books from his canon, but he was a true mystic. And he had a sense of nature. He sent a sense of God in nature. He could talk to trees. He was a seminal voice in the civil rights movement. In fact, every single rights leader, from Martin Luther King to John Lewis to Jesse Jackson, carried Jesus and the Disinherited in their pocket. It was their Bible. And what he studied was how systemic cultural oppression can cause compensatory psychological programs such as fear, hate, and deception. He called them the 3 hounds of hell. And he advocated for love, to love your enemy. And one of the interesting quotes from Howard Thurman was that he felt that white people tended to worship the Christ, but Black people tended to worship Jesus, because Jesus was an anthropomorphic representation of a minority person, poor and suffering. And they could identify with that. And in our email, there's a little passage from Jim Finley, who's one of my faculty members when I did Living School. And he wrote this book called The Healing Path about the childhood trauma he suffered. And he wrote this: God heard my prayer and came to me in the dark and took me to a secret place in God where violence could not find me. His father was a alcoholic that would beat him up and beat his mother up on occasion. Now, when my father got angry and hit me, he didn't know he was only hitting that other little boy, that effigy of myself that others could see. He did not know the real me, who was hidden safely in the secret place in God that my father knew nothing about. And that's exactly what Howard Thurman said about the folks in the South that had to endure much oppression, beatings, etc., that beneath that beaten body, they did not know that place that was hidden in God or in Jesus. And that safe place, that inward place, that's stable and immune to all World 48. So I would recommend highly that get to know Howard Thurman. Now, I borrowed this from Michael Begeman. I would highly recommend that you go back to Michael's talk on October 6th last year. And this is on the second conscious shock. And he expressed the same thing that, you know, that the fathers of the work had left this to us to sort of figure out. And it's gotten more complex, these things like suppressed suffering and cultural oppression and suffering. But if we think in terms of this octave work, I sometimes think, look at the bottom of the slide here, that there's this piston force of impressions that come in. Some are stronger than others. And some are so strong, the unavoidable sufferings are so strong, they can blow out that octave because they just just blow away all the associations that we have and expectations we have in life. It's that disruptive. But in the normal practice way, we become, and just as a quick review, we encounter the work and we start thinking about work ideas and we start trying out self-observation. And as Donald pointed out a couple of weeks ago, then we self-observation leads into self-remembering. And then we start to realize how mechanical we are. And then there's this recognition of one's difficulties. But we keep giving it a go, and it's maybe a few running starts of do, re, mi. And sometimes we fall back down and we do do, re, mi a few times or several times or maybe for years. And then we leap into the other side and we find ourselves there. And this fa, so, la, si, it looks almost like a football field. This seems to be where you start running sprints up and down and be trying to figure out how you can get yourself in shape to make it through here. And it's preparation. It's starting to purge ourselves of things that are unnecessary, that on those little elements that we obsess about, our internal considering, our scripts, our associations, all those things that we fire up when we take in an impression the wrong way. And then when something big happens, everything has been purged out, the pistons are greased, and you may just fly right through here to do. Totally unexpected. So the sequence is this prayer of holy equation. We have a affirming force. It tends to be more of this masculine force, this desire to plant a stake out there in the future, to make something happen. And there's this right brain denying force, the consideration of second force, to refine this thinking. And then holy reconciling comes through. And the higher blends with the lower, and you get something in between. And that leads to incremental progress. It's you don't get exactly what you want. You just sort of get what you need, as the Rolling Stones used to say. And there is you have to have a will to work. You have to that uphill effort requires will. And then rethinking suffering. And Helen Luke has a great description of this. It's like the undercarriage of a vehicle. And all four wheels are sharing and bearing that weight. And that's an apt image of human suffering. Through sharing and balancing and sharing, we can bear these things. We're not going to necessarily transform all our sufferings, but we transform it enough to be bearable. And we bear it. And it's like Keating said, in Christianity, motivation is everything. Our motivation, our sense of duty, and our willingness to bear. Take up your cross. And then this passage that was in our reading and an opening reading from J.G. Bennett. And this is the disposition. And I think these are the prayers for the holy disposition for consciously bearing suffering. So we almost have to be like the second being food. We have to be like air, just to let everything take us, to deny ourselves nothing, to let everything breathe us, to let everything be transmitted through us. We can help one another. And that matches up with the welcoming prayer. We just welcome, welcome, welcome everything that comes to me today, because I know it's for my healing. And it's this series of letting go, of desire for power and control, desire for affection, esteem, approval, and pleasure, desire for survival and security, desire for change of any situation, condition, person, or myself. And when I let go of all those things, I am open to the love and presence of God and God's action within. And that's where the law 3 takes place. Just let go and open. And I think Teilhard really got this idea of park dog duty, which is this idea of conscience and consciousness, that we owe something to the bank account of conscious bearing to the world. And we add to that bank account, we add to the savings, each of us in our lives. And so when he says, if all the people who suffer in the world were to unite their suffering so the pain of the world should become one single grand act of consciousness, of sublimation, of unification, would this not be one of the most exalted forms in which the mysterious work of creation could be manifest to our eyes? That, I love that statement. It's in this broken world that is so optimistic and inspiring. And it matches up with the Abagonian strivings. We're here to lighten the sorrow of our common Father and assist in perfecting others to that degree of self-individuality. So that's the didactic portion, and then I want to tell some stories, but I thought I'd stop to share and see if anybody has any thoughts, questions, or sharings about what we've covered so far. Okay, well, that's fine. We'll move on, and I will resume the share. So here's a little perspective that I'm going to bring. I've shared this with Robin Bloor, that sometimes I find the work a little bit cold. And it seems like it's aiming for the perfection of us and our inner being. And it doesn't feel like sometimes it has a warm beating heart. Whereas the Christian perspective warms it up for me more. And again, I think it's that personification in Jesus who showed us how to be. But I thought, well, why don't I dig around and find out something about Gurdjieff in his most vulnerable moments. And he was a very complicated man. He had a passion for connecting all these spiritual lines in the history of man and coming up with a cohesive story of human consciousness or lack thereof. But he was a man of big appetites who, despite all the working on inner being, his exterior self careened around a bit. He would go through periods of asceticism and then periods where, I mean, almost all of his children were out of wedlock. He had 7 kids, all out of wedlock. He married this beautiful woman, Julia Ostrovskaya, in 1912. And on the right here is his mother, Evdokia Georgiadis. We think she was born around 1845. But these two women, who spoke different languages, found a pig version of Armenian and a pig version of Russian so they could talk to each other. And while he would be sitting and pondering things, they would whisper in this language that only they knew with each other, things in support of him. And they were nurturing presence to him. And Julia was a dancer in his movements troupe and was the high priestess. And she worked the kitchen and she was very quiet, had a sense of fun, but sort of had this composure that you couldn't quite completely read. The other thing about Gurdjieff was he was a terrible driver. He loved to drive automobiles very fast and was involved in multiple car accidents. And in 1924, a very severe one, he had a bad concussion, was in a coma for a while. And his wife and his mother cared for him so well, they basically saved his life. And then in 1925, his mother died. And then in 1926, Julia succumbed to cancer, despite all the treatments they could offer. And I'm going to go back, jumping ahead here. I would like to read this passage from Life is Real Only When I Am. This is about as honest as Gurdjieff gets. And it's, I want you to pay attention to how carefully he analyzes the inner workings of himself as he's pondering this event. I'm going to start off the way this starts off here at the bottom. At that time, there frequently used to come and sit down by me on this bench, on each side of me, two near beings, the only ones close to my inner world. And so, as I sat on this bench and almost mechanically observed the familiar surroundings, in me, by the association of an idea, there began to be recollected the different experiences in this same place. Suddenly, remembering, I visualized as though in reality a picture which I had frequently seen during short periods of rest from my active mentation. So he's really talking about here when he got silent, when he got quiet. And this image came forth. And the image that he's going to be describing here is two figures coming from opposite directions, both stooped and walking with a cane. Both walked with the help of a stick and were stooped. I must confess that the bent figure of the first did not touch me so much because I accounted and accepted this as the normal destiny of every person of this esteemed age. But the bowed posture of the second, I was quite unable to reconcile myself. Each time when I noticed it, there arose in me a feeling of revolt, and my heart pounded like that of a balking horse. So that's a great description of a conscious bearing of suffering, a recollection of a not too remote suffering. And that revolt, is he wailing at the injustice of his young 36-year-old wife dying of cancer? He's more accepting of his mother because of her esteemed age. But he has to sacrifice this suffering. And by observing it and sitting with it, he's transforming it. And so then he goes on, he says, during the period of my greatest occupation with writing, the quality of my labor ability and its productivity was always the result of and was dependent upon the length and gravity of the constating with my active mentation of the automatic, that is passive, experiencings of suffering preceding me concerning these two, for me, dearest women. There arose an unquenchable desire to learn why and what manner my suffering in this instance could assist in the increase of my labor ability. Now that's typical Gurdjieff Beelzebub type writing. And what, just to translate that, what he's saying is that he's analyzing his thought process. It's sort of passive, and he's wondering why he's getting so much energy to be able to write from grieving. And he's wanting to learn why that is. And what he's encountering is the ascensional force of the world within him. There's energy being created for the world. There's also energy created for him by bearing that suffering. This is my grandmother and my grandfather, Ruth and Edward. Edward Solotus Utz was his name. You can see he's staring straight ahead sort of confidently. He was a bow tie kind of Methodist minister. They had Wednesday night revivals, and he appealed to the working person. My grandmother came from a part of our family that nobody talked about much. They had emigrated from Ashton and Makerfield in England. And so it was an industrial coal mining area. And they became coal miners in central Pennsylvania. So they were a coal mining family. She was a coal miner's daughter. And John Sim, her father, my great-grandfather, was a bit of a rascal. He spent 6 months in jail in England for larceny, and then decided to come and join the rest of the folks from Ashton at Makerfield that had emigrated to the U.S. and Pennsylvania to start a new life. He married my great-grandmother, Mary Hart, and they had five boys and three girls, eight kids. And that's how my grandmother grew up. I think if you look at her expression here, there's something more there. It's like I've seen things expression. This picture here was taken in probably 1914. You notice that great-grandpa's not here. This is probably his funeral. And I've seen turn of the century glum family pictures, but this, I think this one tops them all. I think Merritt, my great-grandmother here, has good riddance, John Sim type expression on her face. This is my grandmother right here. And this is Albert. It looks like he's probably about 13 or something. And this is Peter. And they worked, all these guys worked for the Morrisdale Mining Company. And in 1944, I don't know, this is a postcard from the Morrisdale Mining Company. Why anybody would want a postcard for the Morrisdale Mining Company shaft number 3 beyond me, but this is where they worked. And in 1944, my dad and my uncle Blink, they were off it in World War II. And most of the kids have kind of left the nest. So she had three younger ones at home, but they were teenagers and probably not home a lot. And representatives from the Morrisdale Coal Company came to the parsonage to tell her that Albert and Peter were killed in a mining accident with a pillar collapse. So pillars were piles of rock that would be set aside to bolster the walls and also to make room for the vein to get the coal out. And my grandmother was a great bread baker. I remember growing up, she made this really good yeasty bread that when you put it in the toaster, just even got better. and she made great chicken pot pie. She was a really good cook, and she was a very quiet woman, but gentle. And my father said he never saw her cry. And so when they came and told her that, she didn't cry. She just baked bread all day, quietly. And I don't know how many of you are into Canadiata, but I love Canadian music. I mourn the passing of Gordon Lightfoot, and I mourn the passing of Gord Downie from Tragically Hip. But their first big hit was When You Blow It High Dough. And what that means is, it's an old Scottish aphorism. Don't get worked up with frantic attempts to change what is, basically. Don't get yourself all worked up. And the blow on high dough is kind of a baking term. It's like when you put a loaf of bread in the oven and you've overproofed it outside the oven and it's spilling over the pan, when you put it in and it rises with the heat, you're going to blow the top. And then on the right there, you've got a picture of a blown top on a loaf of bread. Blowing on the dough is not going to, you can't unscramble eggs. Blowing on the dough is not going to keep it from blowing. And so you do the best you can. You put your best effort in. You stay conscious. And if it goes bad, you start again. It's also, it could be a reference that going after high dough, thinking you can hit dough when you may need some help. And I compared these two women, and I was just thinking about the oppression of women and how women at that time, in that era, had to play passive roles to their affirming force men, and what they had to bear to get through, and what they were willing to bear. And this is a description of Julia in Roger Lipsky's Gurdjieff Reconsidered, but I think it applies to my grandmother as well. A gentle smile, sad and lovely, was always on her lips. The gray blue eyes looked into the distance with just a touch of fear in them. A truly superior face. Well, about 100 years after that photo of my grandmother with her family was taken, we had a big flood in Wimberley. It was a big flood of Memorial Day flood of 2015. And I remember what a shock that was, of the level of destruction that had occurred. My wife, Kathy, had a yarn shop right on Cypress Creek, and it got totally trashed and flooded and everything turned upside down. People lost their homes. A family lost this one family. The father lost his whole family, his young kids and his wife. So very tragic event. This is one of Kathy's friends, Sandra. She's now 90-something years old, and she helped clean up after that flood. So we had the community all came together. I remember Tom would help dig people out of the muck that they had suffered, the folks that lived by the river. And I just remember going to the high school and dropping off stuff from Home Depot. They needed fans today. They needed this today. It was a great coming together of the community. But then 3 months after that, our son, Tom, 2 weeks from going to college, just came home from summer camp, Camp Longhorn, and was just burning the candle at both ends, trying to straighten things out with all his girlfriends before he headed out to college. And on his way home, fell asleep at the wheel and his car hit a tree and blew up. And then we were confronted with unavoidable suffering. And the first 2 or 3 days was just releasing it from my body, the shock of it. And then there were the mundane things that you had to do to unravel going to college. I had to cancel his mountain bike at the mountain store and cancel these tickets for Lee Bryce and cancel flights. And I just remember this saying from Joan Didion, grief has no distance. Grief comes in waves, paroxysms, sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of life. And that's that force of impressions that comes through. Just there's no more internal considering to do at that moment. They're all blown out. But we were surrounded by a great community of friends, folks from this, our church, folks from Wimberley, family, friends, and they shared that grief with us. And we all shared it together. In fact, our home was known as the cocoon. And so I started to pivot midweek because we heard stories from folks of grief events they had had that I never knew about, I never had heard about. And then all of a sudden, this light bulb went off in me and said, why me became why not me? Why not me? What protected me from this? And so I started to think about the kids that were grieving, and I felt that there was some duty to speak to that. And so I dusted off an excerpt from the eulogy that I gave that night, that day, a week later. Thought I'd share this with you. Everyone is grieving with us, but I want to address the kids and especially to the class of 2015. Your grief is under unusual pressure. Many are soon leaving home, and this has violated your sense of invincibility, and that can be scary. Norm Rowling has summed up the message of the Bible in 2 words. Show up. Look at that Wimberley strong flag. I now know the secret code. That last line, strength, hope, courage. But you just can't put on strength. That is not the starting point. You have to show up. So it reads backwards. Courage, then hope, then strength. It takes courage to grieve. It hurts like hell, and you feel vulnerable just when you're aspiring to be an incompetent adult. You have to go deep into the valley of the shadow of death and face your fears and wail at the injustice and go to your knees. Then comes hope. You look up and you see searchlights from above. It is the Good Shepherd and his army of shepherds looking for you. And you are found and led the path out of that valley. And the climb is hard, and we are all making our way out. But the shepherds lend their strength and help you discover God's strength that has already been given and is waiting for you to find. But take heart, a day will come when we will lie down in green pastures beside cool waters, and we will be restored, and the pain will lighten when anointed by love, and we will be stronger, more loving, and confident in the present moment where love lives. And Tom will be with us in this love. So that's what the community gave to me. And I went from this to this. And sometimes it would go back to this, because grief comes in waves, and it kept coming in waves over several years. But what I have found is a greater capacity to bear it. And I just want to finish with this one passage, and then we'll have some time for sharing. And I just got this book. I'll stop screen sharing now. There we go. This is from Howard Thurman's book, Meditations of the Heart. And I just opened the book and this page came up. And it's called The Season of Remembrance. Again and again it comes, the time of recollection, the season of remembrance. Empty vessels of hope fill up again. Forgotten treasures of dreams reclaim their place. Long lost memories come trooping back to me. This is my season of remembrance, my time of recollection. Into the challenge of my anguish, I throw the strength of all my hope. I match the darts of my despair with the treasures of my dreams. Upon the current of my heart, I float the burdens of the years. I challenge the mind of death with my love of life. Such to me is the time of recollection, the season of remembrance. So now is the time to share anything about the homework or suffering.
Steve, Cammy has her hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me move spotlight so I can see everybody. Hi, Cammy.
Hello, Stephen and everyone. Wow. What an amazing share tonight. And I came into the reading, hearing our reflection, and I had more questions come up with that reading. And I was really confused by the ascensional force of the world until I heard your story. And I guess, and my life hasn't been without some, and I'm very deeply sorry for your loss. And it brought back incredible memories of my own loss and the journey that we take when we experience those sudden and unexpected losses. And even having experienced those, I was still confused by the ascensional force of the world until you really broke it open and really pointed toward the power that manifested in that walk. And so thank you for sharing that and reminding me. Because I think that it's in the remembering of those, of the power in those moments, that both is what gives us hope and what helps us not fear, because we remember that that grace is available to all of us when we endure that intentional suffering.
Well, thank you.
Beautiful share.
Thank you, Cammy. That's beautiful.
Michael and Pamela have their hands up as well.
Okay. Michael? Gotta get the gallery up here.
Hey. My experience that suffering can drive me into myself, or it can drive me out of myself. Both. I think about the story that you told, and I was in Wimberley that day. And there was this movement in you of having the power or the force of that event that, at least for that moment in time, it drove you out of yourself, externally considering, taking into yourself not only your own grief, but also that of the community, Tom's friends. And that is it's absolutely second conscious shock. It's taking us out of our own monad and our own internal considering and putting, and the suffering becomes an energy of relationship, which takes us to what Teilhard said, that if we can connect this. We had a family event today. A phone rang, and our daughter, who was 4+ months pregnant, went to the doctor for a checkup and said, there's no heartbeat. And so there's the immediate body blow of that. There is the shock of that. There is the feeling of helplessness in terms of there's nothing to do. There's nothing to say. And as the day unfolded, I felt myself drawing into consciousness or feeling contact with not just Allie's event, but that this is a human event. I'm sure that there are people in our journey school tonight who have shared the same event as the mother, or as a grandmother or grandfather. And so today I've been present to the suffering, the collective suffering of a life event called losing a child. And it's even put me into this evening, it was moving me into a relationship with my mom, who passed away years ago. And she lost a child before I was born. Her first son died. And this event has put me into an emotional relationship with her, time body wise, that I have never had before. And again, I think that it's just pointing to the transformational potential that is in suffering and that takes us out of ourselves and into a greater relationship with the whole. And I guess that's what this game is about, right? So thanks.
Thanks, Michael. Beautiful.
Lauren has his hand up.
Hey, Lauren.
Well, that was very moving, of course, Steve. And if, as was your share, Michael. And it reminds me that there's a bigger picture here that you both were drawn into, that, you know, we're pulled into this place of the host of witnesses, your mother, Michael, Tom, and his friends. And it feels like we're into some kind of Abelgonian striving place where this is, you know, hopefully we're getting it on an intellectual as well, emotional as well as a body center place. But it feels like it takes us to this great big picture of, I was thinking earlier today that about paying reparations. And here you were quoting a man who had every reason to be angry, and yet you got something to give to all of us, white folks, many of us, not all. And it feels like that there's so much of a gift that we are watching be paid out as we listen to you. A bigger world is opening, and at least it feels like there's a bigger heart involved in this than just the hearts that broke open there in that community that you both spoke of. Anyway, it feels like to quote Thurman in this regard, and all of the suffering that our African-American slaves have, and the indigenous people there who also were enslaved. Anyway, it just feels like it seems like it's reparation. I don't know why I feel that, but anyway, that's how it felt to me.
Thank you, Lauren. Howard.
So that was some incredibly good pieces of information there that I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around or figure out to an extent. And you may know, a lot of you know that my father died when I was young, and you know, young enough that I totally didn't know how to deal with it, or you know, the grief, the loss, and kind of not even realizing what that was all about, or you know, that what death was all about. And I really, you know, from your sharing and some of what Michael shared there too, was going into myself, and a lot of you know, through a lot of my life, you know, useless suffering, unconscious suffering, and that being inside myself like that, a big part of that was and has been and still occurs, that just thinking, and maybe eyes is a better way to put it, eyes within me thinking that it's what does it matter, you know, we're going to lose people, going to be gone myself sometime. So, you know, another part of that unconscious, and that's, you know, I guess I'll place it with useless suffering and unconscious suffering of in being, you know, doing whatever I want because of thinking it doesn't matter, and just being caught up in that, like I say, kind of throughout a good part of most of my life. So it's kind of a revelation for me right now, and I'm still, like I say, I'm trying to put the pieces of that puzzle together to an extent, because it is an awakening. It is awakening for me, and maybe however small right now, but it is thankful for more understanding around that. So that's some useful suffering. So thank you.
Well, Howard, Michael pointed out in his presentation in October that, I think it was a Rodney Collin quote, that if there wasn't suffering in the world, we'd have to invent it. Okay. Because it's the most useful substrate for transformation. And why did God place us in a finite universe with constrictions and limits and suffering? And there's a great quote in Cynthia Bourgeau's book, Eye of the Heart, that all these things, this finitude that we're living within, when infused with love and cured on the rack of time, yields these poignant qualities of forbearance and forgiveness and empathy and caring and sharing and all of that. And if we, so unavoidable suffering generates that. And there's a certain joy in discovering the depth of that, that makes up for the suffering in a way. And I know it's a pivot point to turn your head around on, but I think that's where that lives. But thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Marianne, I guess it's turning over to you.
Well, thank you, Steve. Your last words about the pivot points is a poignant and expansive way to end our evening. Thank you for your presence, your being, for in our community of people who are trying to understand the way. I honor that in you.
Thank you.
So let us know and close our time by affirming and praying aloud, knowing in our heart that God's love has always met and will always meet all my needs. I give freely and receive joyfully. And how blessed I am to simply remember God, to remember this and one another. Protect us, Lord, while we are awake, and watch over us as we sleep, that awake we may keep watch with Christ, and to sleep, rest in Christ's peace. Good night, beloveds.